Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina joins all the other battleground states in sending Donald Trump back to the White House. We look at what went right and wrong for both campaigns in the state. Democrat Josh Stein becomes North Carolina's next governor and may have an easier time of things, given Republicans appear to have lost their veto-proof supermajority. We also recap the down-ballot races and what those outcomes mean. Plus, the Panthers squeak past New Orleans 23-22 here in Charlotte, and then fly to Munich to play a home game there against the Giants on Sunday morning, our time. Oh, and Charlotte FC plays game three of a three-game series with Orlando to keep their playoff hopes alive. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Flashpoint on Sunday mornings. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Happy Good morning. Friday.
Everybody's awake, I hope. We all know the outcome of the presidential race. We all know that the blue wall not only did not hold for Democrats, it also dissolved like sugar in hot water. We also know that North Carolina, in this state, the state Democrats hoped they would help push Kamala Harris from the executive office building next door to the White House, but they went instead for Trump. How wide did the margin of victory end up being in the state for Donald Trump, Steve?
Right now, it's a little over 3 percentage points, which is obviously much larger than in 2020 and about in line with what he won in 2016. I think one thing that's interesting is that when you look at, you know, there was kind of two elections in a way. There was the election in the seven swing states, in which the swing from Biden to Trump this time was about 3 percentage points. In the rest of the country, it was nearly 7. So, you know, the Harris campaign had made some inroads in the places where she campaigned. And if you look at North Carolina, a lot of the areas in the Piedmont were kind of a draw compared to 2020. But there was, again, you know, kind of complete devastation in rural areas for Democrats again. And then across the country, when you look at places like South Texas, New York City, massive swings toward Donald Trump.
So we were one of the seven states considered to be in play, one of the seven states that were going to decide this election, which is a structural problem that works against democracy, and that's a topic for another show. But nonetheless, that was the thought. Was that just a pipe dream? Because clearly it didn't work, not for Harris.
Well, I think I told you last week that she was going to have to overperform Joe Biden in all the urban areas of the state. And she did not do that in Mecklenburg County. She did not do that up in Wake County. She did not do that in Orange County. She did not do that in Durham. The only urban center that she really overperformed him was in Buncombe County. And not only did she not overperform that, like she had to, Trump actually overperformed what he did 4 years ago.
It was interesting.
Go ahead.
To me, Mike, basically the lesson was that Donald Trump is a salesman and he was selling a certain message. And we saw it, particularly in the last parts of the campaign, about retribution against an enemy within, very genderized and racialized attacks on Kamala Harris, the vice president, calling her dumb, calling the Democratic Party demonic. A lot of times, including in his rally in Greensboro, agreeing with folks that were saying horrible things. And we saw in Concord that a lot of it had this religious overlay, his strong white evangelical support, stayed strong, sometimes blessed on stage by Franklin Graham. He used his assassination attempts to somehow insinuate, and a lot of people really agreed with him, that he was somehow saved for this mission.
He didn't insinuate it. He said it, and he said it during his acceptance speech.
And in Concord, people, you know, were yelling Jesus, which seemed fairly blasphemous to me. Yeah. And Kamala Harris, I was at her rally in Saturday in Charlotte. She was offering plans, said her administration would be for everyone, a return out of the darkness, and That is not what America's buying right now. They can
Well,
say it's
see,
the
I was going to
economy,
say
abortion,
they both had their
immigration.
messages. They both were
Yes.
selling a very different message, and America
Yes.
bought Donald Trump's message. Why?
Well, that's what America is. They say this is not who we are, but it is. And they can say it's the economy and the border. And he is strict on abortion rights. She was very open on reproductive health issues for women. But we see again for the third time, white women in majority voted for Donald Trump.
Ben?
I do think there is a disconnect between what the economy is and what Democrats and what the Harris campaign were trying to run on. And I think when you look at, your 401k, it's doing really well. And I think you look at Wall Street and it's doing really well. But I think when you talk to a lot of folks and they say, hey, I'm paying a lot more for gas, I'm paying a lot more for groceries, I'm paying a lot more for rent than I was 4 years ago. Honestly, that's the bottom line for a lot of people. And I do feel like in many cases, Democrats and sometimes the Harris campaign miss that opportunity to connect the
Yeah.
two. And I think Trump capitalized on it.
Mary Ramsey.
And also,
Oh, Mary Ramsey.
I think one area where the Harris campaign struggled a little bit, and you saw this messaging start to come into play pretty late in the game, especially when former President Obama hit the campaign trail for Harris. But this idea that, trying to remind people, hey, there were a lot of issues with the Trump economy too. Yes, gas was cheaper, but a big factor in that was that we were all stuck at home in a global pandemic, so we couldn't drive. And I didn't really hear that messaging until pretty late in the game, this idea that it was more of Trump taking over the really strong Obama Democratic economy that was the good part, and then things started to drop off, and things have not necessarily been great under Biden, but that the Biden administration had made improvements. And that just seemed to be a
Well,
message the Harris campaign could never quite get its arms around and could never quite push to the forefront.
and presidents don't have any control over the price of milk or eggs or chicken or beef in the grocery store. They just don't. And Donald Trump will inherit a roaring economy from the Biden administration, which did cost him inflation because of things, measures put in place to keep us out of a recession. And we have an economy that is the envy of the world. So we'll see if we can keep it, given some of the tax changes that Donald Trump wants to enact. The polls, the final Elon poll prior to Election Day, showed a virtual tie between Harris and Trump. Similarly, other polls across the country showed the race in a dead heat. That obviously did not turn out to be the case. Did the polls get things wrong again, Steve? Or was the margin of error within all of these polls also the margin of victory?
Excuse me, they were the polls were definitely all within the margin of error, clearly, because I think that the popular vote is now what, 3 points, and the average of polls had it about a tie. And there were some polls that got it spot on. It's funny, Rasmussen is the famous or infamous Republican leading pollster that people dismiss. They called the race correctly nationally and in many states. I think in North Carolina, they were pretty close. I mean, the poll averages had Trump up by about one, and he's going to win by three. I mean, that's, I don't think you can ask polls
Okay.
to do that much better. And just one more thing, going into it, a lot of people were saying, look, the polls are showing a tie, but we are one small polling error away from Kamala Harris winning all seven. We are one polling error away from Donald Trump winning all seven states, and that's what happened.
So voters had any number of reasons, personal reasons, for making their decisions. 22-year-old Yoselyn Rosas voted in East Charlotte and told WFAE why she cast her ballot for the vice president.
I just want the best for the country. Anyone that comes here wants to obviously have the American dream and all that. So I pretty much when I voted for Kamala, I feel like she's the right candidate to represent this country and who she represents the country as a whole.
Meanwhile, in South Charlotte, Robert Mostef voted for Trump for several reasons.
Immigration is probably the top of my, the border, it's probably the top of my concern. After that, I would say cutting the fat and a lot of the spending that's going on.
So a lot of people, and I think people in the news business also thought that we would not know the outcome of this election until probably this weekend sometime tomorrow. But instead, we knew something, we knew what the result was around 11 o'clock on Tuesday night. The next day, of course, Kamala Harris conceded, and she and President Biden both phoned Trump to congratulate him. And yesterday, President Biden assured a peaceful smooth transfer of power, something that Trump did not give him on his way out. But that's how things are supposed to work. The Trump administration, or the Trump campaign, had poll watchers stationed around the country and lawyers ready to go, should he have lost this election, to allege voter fraud. Where are the election deniers this morning? Does this election finally mean that our elections are, in fact, fair and not subject to manipulation? Does this victory put these erroneous conspiracy theories to bed once and for all?
I don't think so. If Trump, I write in my roll call column that if Trump had lost, there would be, you'd see many, many lawsuits. You know, I'm wondering where all those people were that 4 years ago were saying that everything was crooked. Did we all fix it? But I think we can anticipate in the future, if it goes another way, you will see these conspiracies come up again and again. There's a certain part of the population that it's, if I win, it's fair. If the other person wins, it's crooked.
And that's un-American.
That will go away.
That's un-American. Ben?
Even on election day, the election day itself, President-elect Trump was tweeting about fraud happening in the state of Pennsylvania. Those claims stopped by midnight that night. And so what President Biden said yesterday, you can't just love your country when you're winning, that this does in fact show that our electoral system, our voting system, our amazing poll workers who dedicate so much of their time does work.
So the North Carolina State Board of Elections reports that 73% of registered voters cast a vote in this election. That means more than a quarter of all registered voters in the state, 2 million people, did not vote. Do we know how that compares to the rest of the country?
I don't know about the rest of the country. It was down slightly in North Carolina from 2020 when we had 75% turnout, which was an incredibly high number. So 73%, a little bit down from 4 years ago, but still historically very, very high.
And Mecklenburg County historically has low voter participation, and evidently was even lower. Only 69% of eligible voters participated, meaning 31%, or 256,000 plus, a quarter of a million Mecklenburg County voters, sat this one out. That's lower than the state average or the national average. Was it worse than our previous averages, Steve?
If you go back to... In the 2022 midterms, only 7 North Carolina counties had a lower turnout rate than Mecklenburg. This year, we're still counting some votes, so things could change. But this year, 11 counties had a worse turnout. So, hooray, improvement maybe? I don't know. You know.
Well, and Democrats were depending on Mecklenburg County to help put Harris over the top in this state. Clearly, that didn't happen. But does anybody understand this apparent disinterest in democracy in Mecklenburg County? I've stumped.
I can't say that I understand it. Although to your point, I mean, Mecklenburg County Democrats invested in an entire infrastructure here as part of the postmortem of 2020 because the turnout among Democrats specifically was so low, and they spent millions of dollars and hired all of these people, and when it came down to it, Kamala Harris got less of a voter share than Joe Biden did 4 years ago in Mecklenburg County.
We may have had fewer voters, but of those who voted, most pulled the lever for Kamala Harris, 65%. That's higher than the percentage of Wake County voters, although there's a bigger population there. They came in at 61.6%, with nearly 76% of eligible voters there participating. There's a few more things to talk about with regard to voter turnout, but we have to stop. We'll do that. We'll come back. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Josh Stein and other races and other things, as well as the News Roundup continues on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison's with us. WFAE's political reporter Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ben Thompson is an anchor and host of Flashpoint on WCNC-TV. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. So more voters here in Mecklenburg voted for Kamala Harris than Donald Trump, slightly higher than the percentage in Wake County. And Democrats were hopeful that a high voter turnout in these urban counties would allow Harris to take the state. That dream evaporated. Was it because voter turnout in urban areas wasn't high enough? Was it because exurban and rural areas were more motivated to turn out and vote for Trump? Was it because of something else, like people simply not wanting to vote for Harris, Democrat or not, so they voted for Trump? Steve?
You know, I think it's a lot of things. In Mecklenburg County, you know, Harris's margins dropped compared to Biden. So across the county, her support was a little softer than it was 4 years ago. And that was true in South Charlotte. That was true in Mint Hill. That was true in Black precincts. So kind of across the board, there was an erosion of support. And then, like I said earlier, the rural counties in North Carolina swung even more to the right. And each election we go through, we kind of have this question of, well, how much worse can it get for Democrats in rural areas? You know, we figure there's a bottom. It's gonna bottom out, but it doesn't. It keeps going, getting worse.
Ben.
One county I watched on election night that was really interesting because I knew it would sort of not be a bellwether, but would indicate how things were going was Anson County. And Anson County has voted Democrat for a long, long, long time. Not just Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton before that, but long before that as well. And this was the first time that they switched for Donald Trump. And keep in mind, Anson County is about evenly split between white and black voters. And it's a very rural area as well. So that was an interesting switch that happened since 4 years ago. Cabarrus County is just the opposite in that Donald Trump, over the last three times he's run, has lost support each time, I think from like 58% to 55% to 53%, I think. But he still managed to win in a swing county like that.
Yeah, and I was going to, just to Ben's point, I was just going to jump in. Cabarrus is a really is a great a piece of hope for Democrats because Cabarrus is becoming much more diverse. It's in essentially kind of a part of Charlotte. And so I think probably by the end of this decade, Cabarrus in some election will go blue.
Mary Ramsey.
Yeah, I was just going to add on, you know, I think these numbers we're talking about pose not just an issue for Democrats in this election, obviously with Harris losing, but a deeper kind of philosophical problem. The strategy we were hearing from Anderson Clayton from the North Carolina Democratic Party over and over again this election cycle was Harris can win if we can drive up turnout in our urban areas and make inroads in rural counties, not win the rural counties, but win, but lose by less than we have in previous elections. And as Steve illustrated, not only were they not able to do both, they weren't able to do either. So, you know, it's really a time for, you know, these Democratic strategists to have to go back to the drawing board and figure out, you know, where can they actually get some wins in a presidential race? Because the strategy that they really genuinely thought could help her get a win here in North Carolina just didn't work in either part of the state.
Mary Curtis.
Yeah, she was running against also some incredible headwinds that have been difficult for any candidate to overcome. One, the right track, wrong track numbers. The majority, vast majority of people in America felt that America's on the wrong track. Also, Joe Biden, the president, fair or not, he has a very low approval rate. I think it's around 40%. And it's very difficult for someone who is associated with him, and she's thought of as part of the incumbent party, to overcome that kind of unpopularity. And this was really, you know, focused on a lot. And it's interesting because it didn't even help overcome it when someone like Trump was joking with Elon Musk about firing striking workers, and yet he won a vast majority of the white and Latino working class, not the African-American working class, but white and Latino, even though the Democrats were so pro-union. So it's really interesting that you can't overcome those national headwinds.
And the we have collective amnesia, because I believe Donald Trump left office with a lower approval rating than Joe Biden has today, with an economy in shambles and a pandemic raging. So we don't remember any of that. He's back. Now, moving on. In North Carolina, we split the ticket with more voters choosing Trump over Harris, but also choosing Josh Stein over the man whose character and rhetoric were patterned after that of Donald Trump, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. Why this dichotomy? We're schizophrenic. Why?
We are, but we have been for a long time, going back decades. I mean, I think 2008, 2012 were the two exceptions of where we voted for the same party, both Democratic and, I mean, both governor and president. But aside from that, typically we do split a ticket between who we're voting for president and who we're voting for when it comes to governor. It's part of our DNA for some strange reason. Interestingly enough, though, Josh Stein, even though Donald Trump won here, Josh Stein, I believe, got more votes than any other person ever has on a ballot in North Carolina.
Mary Ramsey.
And one of the interesting caveats this election cycle is it wasn't just North Carolina that did this. This happened in the majority of swing states. Kamala Harris is probably going to lose Arizona, but Ruben Gallego is going to be the next Democratic senator. Tammy Baldwin was able to secure re-election in Wisconsin, despite Kamala Harris losing Wisconsin. In Kentucky, which was called within minutes for Donald Trump when the polls closed, Democrats were able to handedly defeat a Republican amendment legalizing private school vouchers. That amendment lost in every county in Kentucky, and Democrats ran the effort against it. So it's not just North Carolina. I don't know what the answer is. I think you're going to see a lot of people like Josh Stein, like Ruben Gallego, like Andy Beshear in Kentucky maybe get elevated within the Democratic Party because they seem to have figured out how to win in this era when Democratic presidential candidates have not.
Well, there were also, they weren't female and they weren't Black and South Asian, which I don't think that we can totally say that that is the reason, but you can't be what you can't see. America is one of the few developed countries, or all countries, that has not had a woman, and Trump has both times beaten a woman. And you did see the racialized attacks, him calling her dumb, which was part of it. And to follow what Mary Ramsey was saying, in Missouri, Ruby Red Missouri, they voted to expand abortion rights, to have paid sick leave, and to raise the minimum wage. And yet they voted for Republican candidates who have been against all of those things, where Democrats have been for them. So they're voting for these Democratic policies, but for the Republican politicians. Maybe they feel that, well, now I'm protected, but for the rest of the country, you know, who knows? But that is an interesting pattern.
Yeah, and it could be that we simply don't understand how government works, because if you elect, this time I think President Trump will have a Republican Congress, which will help him achieve his policies, but we quite often elect a president of one party and a Congress of another, and nothing ever gets done. Robinson had been lagging Stein, because he's a problem candidate, but he's been lagging Stein in the polls for a long time, even prior to CNN's allegations, which Robinson has denied. Throughout the campaign, he was criticized for controversial remarks that he's made condemning the LGBTQ community, his characterizations of women who sought abortions, and a comment he made from a church pulpit that some people needed to be killed. Yet, here's what he told supporters during his concession speech.
You know, I'm standing here now, folks, and guess where my head is? My head is held high. And the reason why my head is held high is because I ran a race where I did not have to lie. I did not have to tell half-truths. I did not have to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars demonizing anyone. I simply traveled this state and told people about my vision and told the people of North Carolina that I have an unabiding faith in them.
Breathtaking. Stein beat Robinson 55-40%. That's a 15-point gap. I don't know whether that's more than what was predicted. Ben, you want to jump in here, I know.
All eyes on 2026 and whether or not he primaries Tom Tillis.
Wow. You think he's going to run for Senate?
I think he very well could. And there's no love lost between those two. Tom Tillis, one of the more prominent Republicans that never did endorse him, and also one of the most vocal ones when that CNN report came out. Wouldn't be surprised if he tried to primary Tom Tillis. And of course, as we know, Tom Tillis has been censured by the Republican Party in the last few years and has shown an independent streak that some in the Republican Party have not liked.
Yeah. Josh Stein beat Robinson by more than 800,000 votes and told supporters that partial credit must go to the positive nature of his campaign.
Tonight, the people of North Carolina resoundingly embraced a vision that's optimistic, forward-looking, and welcoming. A vision that's about creating opportunity for every North Carolinian. We chose hope over hate. Competence over chaos. Decency over division. That's who we are as North Carolinians.
His victory of 800,000 plus votes was larger than Trump's over Harris in the state. Trump only beat her by about 191,000-192,000 votes. What can we take away from that, Steve?
I would say one takeaway is that Mark Robinson was probably one of the weakest slash worst candidates in the history of the state or the Republic. And not only did he get crushed by Josh Stein, he definitely contributed to the loss of other Council of State races by Republicans. His toxicity did not stop at his race.
So WFAE spoke with a voter, Peter Chanon, I hope I said his name correctly, a voter in Mooresville who voted for Trump, but responded this way when we asked him which gubernatorial candidate he chose.
That one there, I actually did not, I declined to vote for. I wanted to get more knowledge of those candidates, which I did not get.
Thanks to the controversy surrounding Mark Robinson, we probably knew more about him than we know about Josh Stein. But even though Trump won our state, other MAGA candidates like Robinson, like Dan Bishop, like Michelle Morrow, all lost. How do we explain that?
I think go ahead.
No, I do think there were negative coattails down ballot for them. And I also think it made people realize that it seems like North Carolinians, when they vote for governor and some of these jobs, they want people who will do the job. And we had Hurricane Helene, and we realized when something like that happens, you need somebody who's going to be at work during the job, which, Mark Robinson didn't even do the job of lieutenant governor. And then it also pointed out the extremism of some of those candidates. Do you want someone as a superintendent of the schools who has no experience in the public schools? Who's going to do the job? So I do think it made people think more about just what the people in those jobs do, and they want someone who's competent.
And to be clear, when you referred to Mark Robinson not doing his job during Hurricane Helene, he's part of the Council of State as lieutenant governor, and he missed several votes on emergency relief for victims of Hurricane Helene. During his victory speech, Governor-elect Stein did what most politicians do, including Donald Trump. During his speech, he stressed the need for a coming together.
We must reject the politics of division, fear, and hate that keep us from finding common ground. We will go further when we go together, not as Democrats, not as Republicans, not as independents, but as North Carolinians.
So how is a Josh Stein administration likely to differ from that of Governor Roy Cooper? Steve.
I don't think much at all. I asked Josh Stein this back earlier this year when he was campaigning. I said, how would you differ from Roy Cooper? And he said, I can't think of any ways. So I think politically they'll be the same. The biggest change Josh Stein's favor is that he will, the Republicans will not have a supermajority for the next 2 years. So Josh Stein's veto will carry some teeth this time.
Ben.
Yeah, he will have a more powerful governorship necessarily by definition than Roy Cooper, because he'll be able to veto some of these things, and they will not have, unless they get some carryover from the other side, they won't have enough to override that veto, which automatically necessarily gives him more power.
Is that the lack of a supermajority set in stone? Do we know that for a fact, or could that change as more votes are counted, like absentee ballots and things like that, in the coming days?
I don't believe that is going to change. I think those races have been, there are still some that are outstanding, but I believe that has been settled.
It'll so, be slim, though, if he can get some Democrats to some Democrats, to, if Republicans can peel off some Democrats. But I think that particularly in this first 2 years, because they've been so powerless, that the Democrats will be flexing their muscles a little bit.
Will that change, this lack of a supermajority, will it change the nature of the bills that the Republican-controlled legislature proposes, and will it change them because they're not going to get passed, because they're going to be vetoed by the governor and the veto won't be overridden? Will this moderate things?
I think it'll moderate it somewhat. But again, if you go back 2 years ago, this was the same result we had after the 2020 election, when Republicans fell one seat short in the House. And then, of course, Tricia Cotham flipped to give them the supermajority. And already Republicans are talking about their term as the, quote, working supermajority, that they feel like there are enough Democrats from swing districts who have worked with them in the past and are going to continue to do so.
Because there are some people talking about education in the state who say that with the election of Mo Green to be superintendent of public instruction and Josh Stein to be the governor, and the lack of a supermajority, that this may blunt some of the efforts by the legislature to not fund public schools to their detriment, while giving more and more money to opportunity scholarships and charter schools. And they say this will actually help Mo Green in his efforts to improve public schools. Do we think that's even remotely possible?
Well, I know, speaking to Mo Green and Josh Stein, they both explained that they both feel like they have good relationships with leaders in the General Assembly, and they think that that will translate to better legislation. I think skeptics out there remain unconvinced that that's actually going to happen once they come to pass stuff.
There was one race in the State House that Democrats were watching very closely, the one between Democrat-turned-Republican Tricia Cotham and Democrat Nicole Sidman. A lot of money was funneled into this race by Democrats, $1 million. Right now, Cotham is the victor, but the margin is really slim. Where do we stand this morning on that race?
So we counted. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, yeah. Just going to say, you know, there are still some provisional votes to be counted. That being said, at this point for Sidman, it would really take a miracle. She would need just a massive amount of these provisional ballots to both be counted and to go her way. The odds of that are extremely low. So,
well, the margin on election night was 275 votes. Has that changed?
I believe, Steve, we were talking about this earlier, so correct me if I'm wrong. She may have picked up a handful of absentee ballots yesterday, but not enough to make a significant difference.
I think it's still over 200.
And on election night, Sidman's campaign manager said they would likely call for a recount. Have they?
They have not officially. Sidman did post on social media last night that they're still watching the numbers closely, that a recount is still a possibility. But again, the odds of these provisional ballots making a significant difference are pretty slim at this point.
We also have a new attorney general. We'll talk about Jeff Jackson and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Steve Harrison's with us. He's WFAE's political reporter, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Sunday Morning's Flashpoint program, and Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The Attorney General's race in North Carolina pitted two former members of the General Assembly, now two members of Congress, against each other. Democratic TikTok star Jeff Jackson beat Republican architect of HB2 Dan Bishop 51-47%. Between the two campaigns and political action committees, they were estimated to have spent $31 million on TV and online ads. If that is accurate, it would make this attorney general race the most expensive in U.S. history. So did the outcome surprise anybody? Steve.
I think the margin surprised a lot of people. And I think the margin surprised some people perhaps inside Jeff Jackson's campaign. I think there was a sense that if Donald Trump won the state by, say, more than 2 percentage points, that might be too big of a hurdle for Jeff Jackson to overcome. But he did it. He did it with a lot of votes to spare. Obviously, I think Mark Robinson was a big drag on Dan Bishop. Dan Bishop had, you know, was a close ally of him and had called, said he wanted to be Mark Robinson's sidekick. Jeff Jackson's campaign exploited that. But I think also a lot of credit should go to Jackson himself. I mean, he has probably become the most skilled Democratic politician in the state. Has, like you said, Mike, has an incredible following through his newsletters and social media. So I don't think that his victory was all about Mark Robinson.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Jackson has literally built his own brand here in the state of North Carolina. And you can't say that about too many politicians on either side of the aisle. He has his own brand, and he's done that slowly over the course of the last several years through social media, through media appearances. I mean, people are familiar with him because he's run now for several different races over the last few years. So they're familiar with him. And it is hard to overcome that sort of name recognition.
Yeah, he does have that TikTok following, and he's been very prolific in posting on TikTok and other platforms over the years. But I asked if it was a surprise because we have not, North Carolinians have not, elected a Republican to be Attorney General for 128 years. What's that phenomenon all about?
Nobody knows. They pick Democrats or the Law and Order Party, I guess, when it comes to North Carolina. I do think that Jeff Jackson, though, is a Democratic Party star at this point. The way he has built his brand, as they say, I do think as even the National Party starts asking questions and looking in the rearview mirror and trying to diagnose what they should do next or predict, they will look at Jeff Jackson because he does sort of rise above Democratic, Republican. He has a brand on his own. And I think he has a future in the party and not just in the state.
But. Well, I told him years ago that he's going to end up being a presidential candidate for the Democrats at some point in the future. He laughed at me, but I think it's true. Ben?
Just quickly, you want to watch what he's going to do once he's in office, because he will have, as we've talked about, a Republican General Assembly. He will be the state's top lawyer. He has told me that it will be his duty to carry out the business of the General Assembly, even if he personally disagrees with them. It'll be interesting to see.
And he explained his victory during his speech that night on election night due to his approach to the race.
Being a basically reasonable person who actually cares about other people, I firmly believe that's the way forward. It isn't a slogan. It isn't a faction. It isn't outrage. It's simple, straightforward public service. That's how I plan to do this job, and I can't tell you how excited I am to get started. Thank you so much.
Meanwhile, Dan Bishop quickly conceded on Tuesday night, saying his long run of success had reached its end, and thanks his supporters, his family, God, and Donald Trump.
He's always shared a stage and his microphone that he's provided, and it's just an extraordinary figure in American politics, one that history will remember.
And that is certainly true. If voters here like Trump, why didn't they support one of the most conservative former members of the General Assembly and one of the more prominent members of the House Freedom Caucus in this election?
Jackson was a superior candidate. He just was. And as we've said, he does. I mean, I think the party's going to be looking at people like Jeff Jackson, like Andy Beshear, and see how they are carving their own brand in pretty conservative states.
So Democrat Mo Green beat DeMichelle Morrow for state superintendent of public instruction, another instance of a Democrat beating a right-wing Republican with some views and comments that were considered by many to be extreme. Yet again, Donald Trump, who has views that many consider extreme, won the state. Was it simply her lack of experience as a person in education because she homeschools her children? What was at play here, Steve?
Right or wrong?
Ben,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Right
Ben.
Or wrong, I mean, she had trouble escaping her past comments and past social media posts. I mean, I asked her if her message of cracking down on cyberbullying and violence in the classrooms, was that undermined by her own social media post about the assassination attempts for President Biden or President Obama? And she said, well, there's no perfect person on the ballot because Jesus Christ is not running. She could not escape those statements no matter what she did.
And also, we've seen that people who try to be like Trump, it works for Trump. He has his own brand and people love that. But when they get into that kind of insult and incendiary posts and comments. As Ben said, it just doesn't work for them.
So Mo Green, who appeared on this program for an hour, and Michelle Morrow did not because she said yes and then backed out of it. But I believe she talked to you, Ben, because you're on television. and that plays a role. Don't you think it doesn't?
Maybe.
But anyway, Mo Green was on this program, and he plans, he says, to build or implement a bold vision, direction, and plan for the public schools in this state. Did he elaborate on that at any point in this campaign?
Well, I think the biggest thing he's going to have to fight back against is the, for one, teacher salaries, which everybody agrees teachers need to get paid more. Great. But when you have a Republican General Assembly, finding the middle ground where you compromise and what that is, and then also the expansion of opportunity scholarships. General Assembly seems dead set on expanding those even more. That's not something that he supports. So they're going to hit head to head real quickly.
The daughter of the governor who served this state twice for 16 total years, Jim Hunt, his daughter, Democrat Rachel Hunt, will be the next lieutenant governor. She beat Hal Weatherman 49-47%. The governor's office is weak by design in this state and is becoming more so because of manipulations by the General Assembly. The lieutenant governor's job must be that much more, less powerful. Why would anybody want this job?
I think you get name recognition statewide and, in theory, a platform for a higher office. Although historically, people who have run for governor from the lieutenant governor's office have not fared well.
This is also the first time in 12 years that a Democrat has held the office of lieutenant governor. It's the first time since 2016 that a Democrat has won the office of superintendent of public instruction. But Republicans retain control of other down ballot council of state offices, including commissioner of agriculture, insurance commissioner, commissioner of labor, state treasurer, state auditor. Democrat Elaine Marshall will retain her job as secretary of state, winning on a slim margin of less than 1% of the vote. And former city council member, Charlotte City Council member, Democrat Braxton Winston lost his opportunity to become the state's labor commission. He lost to Republican Luke Farley.
I'm only here because of the people of Mecklenburg County, because they believed in me, because they have seen something in me, and because they have trusted me to be an advocate for them and to represent them. And so I'm so grateful for the people of Mecklenburg County.
Braxton Winston, gracious in his defeat on Tuesday night. He ran as a laborer, a member of the Stagehands Union. Farley is an attorney who has done labor-related work for businesses. Was this a contest?
No. I think the biggest problem, Braxton Winston just had no money. He was not able to raise any money. He was, of all the Council of State people, he was at the bottom. And when, you know, in Council of State races in which the Democrats were not able to tie their opponents to Mark Robinson or have their own money, or in races which the Republicans did not have their own baggage, the GOP did well, kind of just generic default races where people didn't know much about either candidate. Republicans have an advantage, and that showed again on Tuesday.
And Steve, we talked about this on Wednesday morning at post-election. One of the seven seats on the North Carolina State Supreme Court was on the ballot. It pitted Democratic incumbent Justice Allison Riggs against Republican Jefferson Griffin. Riggs came to the Supreme Court because she was appointed to that court by the governor. She came to the Court of Appeals because she was appointed to that court by the governor. It's still a razor thin margin here, and we don't know who the winner is yet, do we, in this race?
Not yet. On election night, Griffin's lead was about 10,000 votes over Allison Riggs. Mecklenburg County yesterday finished counting all of its mail ballots that arrived on Monday and Tuesday. That lowered Griffin's lead to about 8,000. The question, we still have many provisional ballots left to count. Those don't tend to really change to move one way or the other. The question is, I've been trying to figure out how many other counties still have any outstanding mail ballots left. But this was an interesting campaign. Riggs ran a very good race and leaned heavily into abortion rights.
Yep.
Some Republicans felt like she'd crossed the line in talking about that as a justice, but she came very close, or is still very close, to keeping her seat.
And as I said, she was appointed to both the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court by Governor Cooper. She's never run. So is part of this razor-thin margin, despite her messaging about abortion, is it because of the messaging about abortion, or is it because voters didn't know her? They had never voted for her before, even though she's an incumbent.
I think she was able to keep this race close because of abortion and the amount of money she raised and the commercials she had on TV. Because if you look lower at the races for Court of Appeals, Republicans won by much larger margins. So she'd been able to distinguish herself among swing voters. But it may not be enough.
So the state Supreme Court is heavily weighted toward Republicans. A Griffin win would make it more so. How would that likely change any of their decisions going forward?
Well, they've already wielded a 5-2 majority, which changed so much from the voter ID and the redistricting. So that would just harden their, if they had the 6-1, that would just make them, make the rulings even more heavily toward the Republicans.
Voters also said yes by a wide margin to the constitutional amendment restricting voting to citizens only. There was a similar amendment in South Carolina to their constitution, which also passed with 86% of the vote there. Stephanie Arteaga with the Carolina Migrant Network says it created a false narrative aiming to question the integrity of our election system.
And it is certainly playing on this national rhetoric that is intentional about casting doubt on our neighbors and casting doubt on our governmental systems.
Since non-citizen voting is already illegal in the United States and in the North and South Carolina constitutions, was this the intent, or were there other reasons?
I think measures like this, like you mentioned, it was also on the ballot in South Carolina. This is something we've seen in other states in recent election cycles, too. I think this was an idea, on the Republican side, this was something that could really motivate their base. The Republican Party has made voter integrity and immigration such a big issues for their core base in recent years that this was really seen as something that could motivate turnout on their side.
And also people think that maybe this law will lead to other laws restricting voting and citizenship. And so that's why a lot of folks were urged by the Black Political Caucus and other groups to vote no.
So the Panthers tried something new last week. They won. And they will play the New York Giants at home on Sunday. But the home game will be in Munich, Germany, early in the morning, like 9:30 or something like that, Eastern time. We're giving the Germans a treat here by making them watch American football between two of the worst teams in the NFL. Mein Gott. Coincidentally, 8 members of the Charlotte City Council have also traveled to Munich. And according to Councilman Malcolm Graham, who chairs the Economic Development Committee, this is about a lot more than football. Ben, okay, I'll bite. What's it about?
Yeah. Well, for one, I'd like to say the game is playing on WCNC Charlotte on Sunday morning. So with that plug out of the way, my colleague Nate Morabito has done a great job investigating this. $80,000 is what the city's spending to send two-thirds, about 8 city council members and 6 staffers. The city has decided not to pay for tickets to the actual game itself, but they are including a trade show, some marketing seminars, as an effort to go retain and recruit some German businesses. That's what they say is the point of the trip. I did not know this. Evidently, though, there's 250 German companies here in the city of Charlotte, more than any other foreign entity invested here in Charlotte.
You would have known that if you'd listened to Charlotte Talks on WFAE mornings at 9, because we've done several shows on that, Ben.
Dueling plugs here.
That's right.
I love it. Yeah.
I appreciate it.
It is called Mecklenburg, right?
That's true. Very true.
That's right. That's exactly right. So they do expect some business out of this, or at least the cultivation of relationships that might really lead to business. It was announced yesterday, if the election weren't enough, that 43 research monkeys had escaped from a facility near Georgetown in South Carolina. Officials were quick to assure everybody that the monkeys are not infected with anything, but they were on the loose. I mean, they're research monkeys. They make them sick. And they added that they don't believe this was any reaction to the election, the escape of the monkeys.
Yeah. But they can bite your face. Yeah.
That's right. So the monkeys have escaped in South Carolina. The Panthers and most of the city council are in Germany. And Charlotte FC is in Orlando. I hope somebody turned out the lights. Charlotte FC is on a mission to win game three of a three-game series in Orlando. And if they do, they will continue on their playoff journey. The Orlando match is on Saturday at 6 p.m. It is not on WCNC-TV. I just want to point that out. Ben Thompson, however, is on WCNC. He joined us along with Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.